Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 248 of Registry Matters. Good evening, fine sir. Happy second episode of December. Yeah, this would be the second episode of December. How are you?
It is indeed the second episode in December. And I'm doing okay considering my age.
I know, right? Do they, like, doctors, you're like a first impression kind of person for them, that they have never seen the likes of you before, of that age, advanced age.
That is correct. When they run my blood and when they look at my joints, they say that it's remarkable, unlike anything they've seen in their whole medical practice.
Well, very good. Let's see. Anything at all you want to banter about? Can we talk about politics, please? Can we piss off people?
I don't think we've got much political on the agenda tonight.
I don't believe so.
Although indirectly, everything is related to politics, but we don't have any. I'm not doing any economic analysis tonight or anything like that.
Do you have any comments about Brittany Griner being released for the trade for Dr. Death or whatever his name is?
Well, now, see, I just said there wasn't going to be any politics. There you go.
It doesn't seem like a fair trade.
What's unfair about it?
He is like, I'm not saying human for human. Like, I mean, they have the same value, but she is just, I don't want to diminish it that much. She's simply a basketball player, and he is like a known arms dealer, like running around killing people. She throws balls in a hoop.
Well, I don't know anything about what he did, what he's convicted of, so I'm talking without sufficient information. But isn't there a legitimate market for arms sales? Isn't the United States the biggest arms purveyor on planet Earth? I mean, don't
That's
we sell more
correct.
Armaments than every other nation?
That's probably true. Well, but they're approved by Congress then, so it is we the people that do this, right?
Well, what was the nature of the arms he was selling? I don't know. Like I said, I don't know enough about it, but anytime we can get an American free, it's generally a good thing, like former New Mexico governor and UN Ambassador Bill Richardson said. And human for human, yeah, we certainly could have decided to leave her there had we wanted to, but yeah, she's home, and the Russians.
There's a lot of pressure. There was a massive amount of public pressure to do it.
Absolutely, and the Russians have said they're willing to trade Paul Wieland to keep the door open to negotiations, but they want a spy for a spy. He's been convicted of spying, and they say that they want to trade a spy for a spy. I think a couple of observations. First of all, I don't know, just because you're a Marine, that doesn't make it potential that you're spying. I don't know that I can come to that conclusion.
Fair.
So he very well could have been spying in his capacity of a Marine, but the fact of the matter is he was convicted of it, correct?
Yes.
Just as she was convicted. Americans become very righteously indignant when some foreign national is convicted here and they think that our laws are too harsh, and we tell them, well, these are American laws and you have to abide by American laws when you're on American soil. But the same thing would be true when you're on Russian soil. If you're not allowed to have CBD oil, that is their law. And their penalty schemes are just up to what they would like, just as our excessively harsh penalty schemes are up to us as Americans.
Yep.
And it's really difficult for us to have the high horse about penalty schemes when we incarcerate at a higher rate than any other nation, including Russia. So.
Moving along then, I was minorly involved in this conversation, and somebody posted something, but then, so I jumped in after an individual made a comment. So the person said, and we were talking about sex offender laws, most of these draconian laws are not voted on by the people. They're just made law by the government to further their own agendas and make themselves look good to the people. And I wrote back, I said, most everything is done by proxy, meaning we vote for a candidate to represent us, to do the things that we want them to do. So then very few things are full democracy. Am I wrong? That's what I wrote back. And then, so the response was, and this is where I want you to give me some commentary. This is also related to someone that said something on YouTube. In that way, then, yes, you would be correct. If you voted for your candidate, you voted for laws that plague us then. Just you have to know your candidate's intentions before voting, I guess. But then I write in my candidates when I vote. Mickey and Goofy are gonna win one of these times. Can't be any worse than the morons we got now. So, Larry, if we have morons, we can fix this. If you don't like Kyrsten Sinema, if you don't like Mitch McConnell, if you don't like any of them, you can unvote them. Your turn.
I'm truly puzzled when a person will make a comment like that. And it's part of my real frustration and sadness of the 5 years we've been doing this program. Because I've tried to be straight up and down the middle with factual presentation. Although people accuse me on YouTube of being otherwise, I try to give concrete examples of what the public policy proclamations are. We play it as straight as possible. When someone runs for office and they campaign on a platform that they're going to be tough on crime, that they're going to make sentences harsher, that people need to suffer and be incarcerated for long periods of time to keep the community safe, and they vilify the other side of the aisle that wants to let people out and have second chances, and they weaken the First Step Act, and they do these things, we give the concrete examples with supporting evidence. We give the sources. We play the audio clips of the people speaking this themselves. And your job as a citizen is to pay attention to what people are telling you. They tell you what they are for and what they would like to do and which way they lean. Trust them on that. It would behoove you to do that. Trust them when they tell you that they believe in law and order. Trust them, because that's what they mean. Now, there are things they tell you that they would like to do that they're not able to do, because we live in a democratic system where you have to secure other support other than your own. So you might want to close Guantanamo, for example, which Obama pledged to do that. He was not able to achieve that goal because there wasn't support in Congress for closing Guantanamo, although they did dramatically reduce the population of people being held in Guantanamo. And of course, the people that tend to lean conservative were very much against that. They said they were turning loose terrorists to fire on Americans again. But I'm really disturbed that someone would make a comment like this. You don't directly vote on whether we're going to make a felony, a misdemeanor, a felony, or whether we're going to make a felony that's a fourth degree, a second or first degree felony. You're correct. You don't vote on that. But you vote on the person who runs for office that will make those decisions. You have opportunity to give them input when they're on the campaign trail and tell them that that doesn't represent your values, and that if they persist with that position, that you will be withholding your support and possibly voting for their opponent. That's your responsibility as a citizen. Voting for Donald Duck or whatever he said he would do, I mean, that's just a childish reaction that is not productive, and that does not move the ball forward.
All right. Let's move along to a listener question that came in. I've listened to the 2 episodes about Interstate Compact, and you people are too much. What good does it to tell us what is right there? God, what good does it do to tell us that there is a right to a probable cause hearing and then turn around and say that you don't know how to enforce the right? What good is a right that cannot be invoked?
Who sent that in?
That's a good question.
Well, I don't think that I said that the right cannot be invoked, nor did I even suggest that to my recollection. To the contrary, I suggested that, one, the right should be raised with your attorney if you're in that position, and not to waive the probable cause hearing, and do not agree to an extradition hearing rather than a probable cause hearing. And I said that if nothing works, then you should have an issue to raise on appeal that you didn't get the proper due process during the retaking and revocation proceedings that were held. But that is somewhat of a good question, because a right that exists that cannot be enforced, particularly if no one seems to know what you're talking about, it's very difficult. Oftentimes you're sitting in pretrial, pre-adjudication, you're already convicted, but you're sitting in a probation violation detention facility, and you have very limited access to communicate with attorneys, and the conditions are usually not optimal for long-term staying, and you want to get out of the place. So it's very tempting to sign anything just to move the process along. But those temptations should be weighed against the fact that you may be put back in a state that's quite a distance from where you're being held in detention, and you may not be able to have what would be considered a proper revocation hearing, because the witnesses that may support your version of what happened, they're in the state where you're serving your probation, and they're not going to be able to make it to the state. If you're in Alabama and your revocation is going to take place in Idaho, how many of witnesses that are favorable to you are going to be able to go to Idaho to testify on your behalf?
All right. Moving along then, sir.
Well, that's about all I can say, is that I agree. I mean, I'm aware of this conundrum for the difficulty in getting these probable cause hearings. I think this will bleed over into one of the articles that we talk about later about bail reform, where you see that systemically, just because something is an established right and you assume that attorneys should know the process and judges should know, when we get to that segment, I think we can tie these back together. And just because it's an established right and has been established since 1972 and 1973, this is long standing case law that you have the right to a preliminary determination of probable cause before you're shipped across the country. This is not anything new.
Well, just so from my own personal point, like when everything first started hitting the fan, I was like, man, I got this. I can handle this. I'll go talk to them. I'll clear this whole thing up. So right off the bat, we play that whole section from the law professor that's don't talk to the police. Like that, we don't teach that. So you don't know what you should do. It's something that you most likely don't have a lot of experience with, of dealing with the whole apparatus, the whole industrial complex that it is. And then after the fact, like, you just want to keep your head down and keep your nose clean. But then some kind of revocation hearing thing comes up, and you again don't know the rules. So you're playing the whole game blindfolded and spun around.
And you expect, from what you were taught in your civics and your education growing up, that the attorneys do know the rules, and you expect that the courts and the attorneys on both sides of the equation are going to do their best to protect your rights. And you're shocked when you find out that isn't necessarily the case.
Right. Well, let's move along to a question from Michael, and that's the handwritten one, correct?
Well, there's the question two for REM 248.
Uh-huh.
Yep, that's the one.
All right. So hello, and thank you for doing such a great program. I'm hoping you might be able to help me, as well as a few others in prison. Here in the state of Nevada, the courts add a special sentence of lifetime supervision to what seems to be most PFR type charges. None of us are really clear on what lifetime supervision is or what it will be required of us. We keep getting directed to Nevada Revised Statute, NRS 176A.410, but whatever. Okay, but it just lists all the probation requirements. NRS 176.0931 states that lifetime supervision commences after any period of probation or any term of imprisonment and any period of release on parole. It also talks about petitioning to be released from it after 10 years, but not what it is. As far as we can tell, it's not registry, not probation, and it's not parole, in which all the NRSs we've read made clear when explaining rules and stipulations. Are you able to explain what the special sentence of lifetime supervision is in Nevada and what the details are? Thank you for your help, Mike. So up on the screen, if you're watching on the YouTubes, I have the document posted, and Larry is going to describe all of the things.
Well, now I wouldn't go quite that far. So what I'm going to do is tell you that as a general proposition, community supervision for life, lifetime supervision, various descriptions they have for these supervision schemes that kick in after your regular post-prison supervision, they're handled very much like the supervision that you discharged. That was you know, this is so bizarre, but you've got 5 years of parole, for example, and then when you complete that, then you've got CSL, as it's known in New York, as a community supervision for life. But the conditions don't change much, and as best I can tell, that's the case in the state of Nevada as well. So I found this document that I think will be helpful, and I'm going to actually send it to the person who wrote this. And it's called PFR Conditions of Supervision, and it has quite a few bullets, and we probably don't know if we want to read every single one of them, but our reader's going to read the ones that are most significant in terms of what you need to be on guard for, because I will just about assure you that these conditions are going to be in your lifetime supervision after you complete your regular supervision. That's what I can almost guarantee you from what research I've done. So pick some of these bullets and tell him what he's looking at, what people are okay. looking at in that state.
I'm going to read quickly, Larry. I can get through these, but I will read quickly. Okay?
All right. Let's see what you can do.
All right. Submit to a search and seizure of his person, residence, or vehicle, or any property under his control. Surrender your Fourth Amendment is where that one's going. Any time of the day or night without warrant by any parole or probation officer, any peace officer, for the purpose of determining whether the defendant has violated any conditions of probation or supervision of sentence or committed any crime. Next, reside at a location only if it has been approved by the parole and probation officer assigned to the defendant, and keep the parole and probation officer informed of his current address. Accept a position of employment or a position as a volunteer only if it has been approved by the parole or probation officer assigned to the defendant, and keep the parole and probation officer informed of the location of his a position of employment or a position as a volunteer. Abide by any curfew imposed by the parole probation officer assigned to the defendant. Participate in and complete a program of professional counseling approved by the division.
Stop there. Submit. Now, let me just ask you this. This seems so bizarre. So let's say hypothetically you had 5 years of supervision and you completed a program of counseling. I know in my state they would actually keep you counseling forever and ever, because it generates money for the treatment provider. But does this mean that conceivably that you could be in counseling and treatment for another 10 years out of your pocket? Because that's what it says. You can petition for removal from this after 10 years. Now, that's sad.
Well, I mean, isn't that left vague, that it just says participate in and complete a program of? So the program could be 10 years in length, or the program could be 3 months in length.
Yep. So
I'm sure it's not. Then moving along, submit to periodic tests as requested by the parole and probation officer assigned to the defendant to determine whether the defendant is using a controlled substance. Don't do drugs. Submit to periodic, I love this one, this is my favorite, submit to periodic polygraph examinations as requested by the parole and probation officer assigned to the defendant. Abstain from consuming, possessing, or having under his control any alcohol. Why is that listed? Why wouldn't the alcohol one be listed with the substance abuse, Larry?
I don't know, but you know, that bothers me because that's a legal product, but yet when under supervision, you can't use it.
All right. Not have contact or communicate with a victim of the sexual offense or witness who testified against the defendant, or solicit another person to engage in such contact or communication on behalf of the defendant, unless approved by the parole and probation officer assigned to the defendant and a written agreement is entered into and signed in the manner set forth by subsection 2. Don't use aliases or fictitious names. Do not obtain a post office box unless the defendant receives permission from the parole or probation officer assigned to the defendant. Do not have contact with a person less than the age of 17 in a secluded environment unless another adult who has never been convicted of a PFR type offense is present and permission has been obtained by the handlers assigned to the defendant in advance of such contact. Not be in or near a playground, park, school grounds, motion picture theater. Hold on, man. We can't go to the movies?
Can't go to the picture show.
Man, and who calls it that? Motion picture theater. Listen, it's all digital now. There's no film running through the thingamajigger anymore. It's not going. You remember that?
I do indeed. That was those were invented when I was a child.
You were one of the guys that had the hand crank turning the picture. All right, so don't go to the movie theater or a business that primarily has children as customers or conducts events that primarily children attend unless approved by your handlers. Comply with any protocol concerning the use of prescription medication prescribed by a treating physician, including, without limitation, any protocol concerning the use of psychotropic medication. Do not possess any adult material that is deemed inappropriate by the parole or probation officer, blah, 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 your handlers. Do not patronize a business which offers adult material in the form of entertainment and which is deemed inappropriate by your handlers. Do not possess any electronic device capable of accessing the internet and not access the internet through any such device or any other means unless possession of such a device or such access is approved by your handlers. Do you want to stop there and rail on that one for a second?
Yeah, that one's very problematic because it's a necessary thing in the modern society that we live in.
And the last one is, if the defendant expects to be or becomes enrolled as a student at an institution of higher education or changes the date of commencement or termination of his enrollment at an institution of higher education, advise your handlers. As used in this paragraph, institutions of higher education has the meaning ascribed in another publication, but probably trade school, college, something like that. So there you go.
Those are very similar to what we would have here. They're not as detailed as what we would have here. We've got a much longer behavioral contract here, but, to Mike and all those out there that are listening, you're going to have conditions very similar to these, regardless whether you're on federal supervised release or whether you're on state imposed probation, unless you're in the state of Maryland, which is pierced the wind-driven snow, or unless you're in a particular county in Georgia, which we will leave nameless. But otherwise, these are very common types of things that you're going to be encountering. And I think you're going to have them on your lifetime supervision as well.
I could say, you know, not word for word, but they are very similar to the 23 or whatever that I had in Georgia.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Similar. So we were trying to broaden the audience knowledge. We've got people who've not been under supervision, family members and stuff, and they're yearning for this information. And I do apologize for how long it went. But the people who have not seen these in writing that are listening and trying to get ready for helping their loved one when they come out, hopefully this helped them to understand the types of things that they're going to have to be aware of from the supervising authorities and how they can help their loved one be successful.
Just a question that's coming across in chat. Are these lifetime? So is Nevada one of those like you're on probation, parole forever?
Apparently.
And during that whole time, you have these?
Apparently there is a group of offenses that move after their standard supervision. They go into, if you have those offenses, you go into a period of lifetime supervision. And it's that way in New Jersey and some other states, which you can petition to be off of in 10 years, according to the writer. I didn't do that diligent of research to see what the petition process is like. But the essence of the question is, yes, you're going to have almost identical conditions, I would think, regardless of what they name the supervision, if it's a sexual related offense.
I would agree. I mean, yeah, most of those look, other than the Georgia one where it says, I shall never drive alone, especially. It's like, seriously, how am I supposed to do that? Okay, then moving along to some articles, and then we'll move over to some more kind of feature stuff.
Sounds good. You've got quite a few articles in here. You must have worked all afternoon writing this stuff up.
I did definitely work all afternoon on this stuff. This first one that you wanted to talk about comes from the NPR place. And you people put this article in that pertains to sexual assault in the military. And the headline is House passes defense bill that includes proposal to combat sexual assault in the military. And I note that the bill cleared the House on a bipartisan, 350-80 vote. That doesn't really leave a lot of room for anybody that said no. I mean, that's a lot of folks.
Yes, because keep in mind, this is the National Defense Authorization Act. that this is contained in. So this is something that traditionally has been very bipartisan. So yes, it passed. You are correct. And since it pays for the entire Department of Defense, and the bill generally passes each year with huge bipartisan support. In fact, you remember back what happened in 2020 when former President Trump vetoed the National Defense Authorization Act? You remember that?
I do recall that, I believe, yes.
And what happened?
He was promptly overridden, as you predicted, I believe, in a previous episode that it would. And what are the nuances of this, and explain how it impacts we people, the PFRs?
Well, the effort was led by a New York senator to get this provision in, that this is subject to this article. I'm trying to pronounce her name. I think it's
Kirsten Gillibrand.
Gillibrand?
It's Gillibrand.
She's been working on this for a decade to force such cases and other serious crimes, such as murder and domestic violence, out of the chain of command and under the purview of trained prosecutors. She and others, they assert that sexual assault cases in the military have been plagued with concerns about victims who fear coming forward to see prosecutions led by their own commander. And overall, a very low share of each cases go forward and to trial and resulting in conviction. So that's the problem she's trying to fix, so she says.
And according to Senator Gillibrand, this is that's always one of those weird ones. Is it an historic or a historic? This is a historic milestone in our efforts to reform and professionalize the military justice system. She continued, and while it will take time to see the results of these changes, it is still important for us to celebrate this victory and continue our fight. I thought you people have claimed that the Democrat Party is more on our side. Can you admit that this is not a positive step for we people?
I cannot say at this point that this particular legislation, because I've not read it in its entirety. It's more than 4,000 pages long, and it will be in the show notes, hopefully, for those who doubt me. But yes, I have not read it, so I'm really not able to say it.
You said 4,000?
Yes, I said 4,000 pages. I did. The Department of Defense is a very large operation, and the legislation that keeps it running is super complex. This is one of the funny things when I hear lawmakers claim that they don't vote on a bill that they haven't read. That's BS. Every lawmaker votes on bills that they have not read. It's not possible to fully read all the massive proposals that they consider.
Don't they have a bunch of aides or pages, whatever the term would be, and they all read, like maybe he had 10 or she had 10 and they read 400 pages each, and then they summarize back to the individual that would be voting?
Yes, that is what they do. But you get criticized for that. People who have no idea what goes on in legislative chambers, I think we had a representative here a few years ago that he got chastised for not reading something because he admitted on a TV interview that he hadn't read it, and he got chastised. He's no longer in office, but he said, you know, my staff read it, and people said, well, we pay you $170,000 a year to do that. Well, it's just not feasible to do that. If you're going to read a 4,000-page bill, tell me how long that would take with average reading speed.
It would take me about 4,000 days. a senior Democratic aide touted the new changes in the plan, saying it strengthened the fight against sexual harassment in the military by requiring independently trained investigators to probe such concerns and place it under the jurisdiction of a so-called Office of Special Trial Counsel. Outgoing California Democrat Representative Jackie Speier led the fight focused on addressing sexual harassment since the murder of Army Specialist Vanessa Julian, who faced such concerns while she was based at Fort Hood, Texas. And what's wrong with this part, do you think?
So, just for those out there in Spanish surname, that would be pronounced Guillen, but who's keeping score? I don't know yet. I just have my concerns because of what we were told by Ashley, who was with us a few weeks ago, and she stated that their economic incentives for those to make allegations. And if that is the case, we cannot be sure of how this will play out when it's fully implemented.
It's now touted as a system of justice that is worthy of their sacrifice. The article notes that for years, Gillibrand's legislation was met with opposition from the Defense Department, some Republicans, even Democrats. Last year, she saw a major breakthrough partnering with Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst, a combat veteran, to pick through bipartisan support to approve a plan in the Senate. Does this mean everyone is on board now?
Well, it does not. Senator Gillibrand and Rhode Island Democratic Senator Jack Reed, who happens to chair the Senate Armed Services Committee, openly sparred over several Senate floor sessions last year about this proposal. So according to the article, no, it doesn't mean that at all. I've said consistently throughout this podcast that the Democrats are not right on some of our issues. This would be one where they're not right, but try to understand the reason why they take the position they do. They typically take a position on stuff like this that's emotion. They have bought into the thing about justice shouldn't have an expiration date, so they're not on our side on statute of limitations where they should be. And on this, they have drank the Kool-Aid about all this massive amount of sexual misconduct in the military. And women represent a huge Democratic voting bloc, a huge Democratic voting bloc. The Democratic Party has lost the male vote, particularly the white male vote, a long time ago. And the Democratic Party, for political reasons, has to be on the side of protecting women who are serving the nation. They just have to be. And again, I don't make these rules. I'm just simply telling you the reality of the political pressure they're under. So even if they have, like Senator Reed from Rhode Island, even if they have reservations, it's difficult politically to express those reservations because you're alienating one of the largest, if not the largest, voting bloc of the Democratic Party if you say, well, we don't care.
Now that it's under the Office of Special Trial Counsel, Gillibrand said it marks a sea change that could help better protect service members. She went on to say, we now have a system of justice that is independent, that is transparent and accountable, that will hopefully reduce or be free of bias. Do you think POTUS, Mr. President Biden, will sign this?
Of course he will. And if he didn't, he would be promptly overridden, just as Trump was back in 2020. He did express, the White House has expressed some concerns, I noted throughout the article, but it wasn't about that this particular provision, but there were provisions of concern. But he'll have no choice but to sign this, and he would not take the loss of political capital to veto a National Defense Authorization Act. I mean, he may be having signs of senility, but he has not forgotten how promptly Trump was overridden when he vetoed the National Defense Authorization Act. Not going to happen. Not going to happen.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Another article that you wanted to cover was from The Appeal, and Georgia Sex Offender Registry traps people in debt. As I said, it's from The Appeal. So you people put in this article named How Georgia Sex Offender Traps People in Debt and Homelessness from The Appeal. And I think you want to dig in deeper than we typically do with articles. So go for it.
I do want to dig a little bit deeper. And the person in the article, where I didn't see the name, so we're going to talk about the person. And that's who we're talking about, the focus of the article. It says, I was arrested in 2010. While engaging in, my glasses are getting fogged up, sex work to survive, and later forced to register as a PFR. Since then, social stigma, footage laws, and crushing monthly court debts have made it difficult to get back on my own 2 feet and succeed after prison. I'd like to show some of the barriers people face in Georgia. That's the purpose. And I'm sure these barriers are very similar, but you know, we both have some connection to Georgia, and we're familiar with how things operate in the Peach State, so this article presented itself.
The individual stated, in 2010, at the age of 20, after 6 years of engaging in sex work to survive, I was arrested and charged with pimping, pandering, and exploiting a minor who was over 16 years old. In 2012, I was convicted and sentenced to 30 years, with 14 to be served in custody and forced to register, blah, 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 blah. As my public defender so appropriately described it, I was depicted by the media as some sort of Guido the killer pimp and accused, I maintain falsely, of terrible acts befitting only a terrible person.
So, well, he might not be a terrible person at all. He may have just been in survival mode.
According to the article, it's well known that police target sex workers, criminalizing their means of survival and contributing to sex offense-related convictions and statistics. In particular, police target BIPOC and LGBTQ sex workers. BIPOC, Larry?
I have no idea what that is. I'm hoping someone in chat will enlighten us.
Yeah, please tell me what BIPOC is. Especially the many disenfranchised, ostracized, and homeless teens and young people engaged in the trade for survival. Why do you think they do that?
Why do they do the arrest and investigations? Because it sells well in public opinion. If you can go out as in law enforcement apparatus and you can say that you're running these sting operations and you're catching these pimps that are prostituting our youth, nothing is more heart-tugging that I can think of than that. So these sorts of arrests and patterns by law enforcement, they cater to public's hunger for a spectacle, and it pads conviction rates and while furthering the general rhetoric of perversion and predation. Now, that's what the appeal said, but clearly it sells. And again, folks, if you don't want this stuff to sell politically, you have to register. You, our listeners, you out there have to register with the people you elect that you find this objectionable. When you see them on TV making comments and grandstanding, you have to send an email. You have to call. You have to tell them, I find your behavior appalling. That's when it will stop.
By the way, BIPOC is Black, Indigenous, and People of Color. So there was that. And he stated, I didn't know at the time that I was fulfilling a narrative around crime and sex offenses, nor did I know about the vicious reincarceration cycle of the registry and potentially lifelong monetary peonage to the criminal in justice system. But I do unfortunately know one thing now. Sex offender registries are debt traps that cause mass homelessness and mass incarceration. Dig into that one.
Well, in Georgia, first time technical violation by someone on the registry is a felony punishable by up to 30 years in prison. Now, make sure you heard what I said, 30 years. In the land of the enchantment of New Mexico, a registry violation is a fourth degree felony punishable by up to a maximum of 18 months of incarceration. And it's not a serious violent offense, which means in most instances, you're going to get day for day. So you're going to do a whopping 9 months if they max you out. Under the state's recidivism statute, in addition to that 30-year potential, a second violation triggers a provision where there's no parole eligibility, meaning that you will have to do that 30 day for day in Georgia. And it is so difficult to secure housing for people with PFR convictions, and that and the outskirts of at least four Georgia cities, I'm assuming it's the major cities, that they're just loaded with encampments for people that can't find housing. I'm guessing that would be Atlanta, Savannah, maybe Columbus, you know, the places where the population centers are, maybe Macon. But there are places where there's just nowhere to go.
Yeah, right. The article states that prisoners within 15 months of their parole or maximum release date can apply for placement in a TC, which is a transition center, where they may have their own clothes and leave the facility each day for work release. He stated that my application was denied. I was told I couldn't be placed on work release while still receiving gender-affirming treatment. I'd won through litigation. That's not funny, Larry.
It's definitely not funny. He stated, as a citizen on the registry, I'll be paying for my ankle monitor, mandatory treatment classes, monthly urinalysis tests, my annual polygraph test, and of course, my parole officer's valuable time, which means supervision costs. These charges will accumulate to at least $400 to possibly $800 per month. If I cannot keep up with these fees and with rent simultaneously, it doesn't matter which bills I choose to pay, which he's saying that if I can't pay all these, I'm going to fail anyway. So
I will, I frequently re-reference this. Go back to, I believe it's June, maybe 2016. There was an episode of Freakonomics. I can leave a link in the show notes to it, but it is, we make sex offenders. Why do we make sex offenders pay and pay and pay and pay and pay? Something like that. Good, incredibly good episode that describes that we are going to put approximately a $10,000 debt on someone coming out of prison with a PFR type offense. The article notes that it's terribly easy to land in on the PFR registry in this country. The U.S. Department of Justice reports that children are accused of committing roughly a quarter of all known sexual offenses and more than one third of all sexual offenses against kids. At the time, there are more than 200,000 people on the registry for conduct that occurred while they were a minor. Does the average person, Larry, do you think that the average person realize how easy it is to find yourself on the PFR list?
No, they do not, because of the terminology it's used. You know, they use like sexually violent, predators, they have all these things, rapists, child molesters. So they do not realize how easy it is to be a registrant in most states. And PFRs in Georgia are not able to work within 1,000 feet of public parks, schools, childcare facilities, or any other places where minors are known to congregate. And law enforcement even invents some additional requirements that prohibit registrants from working in restaurants. Multiple studies have linked sex offender registries to increased rates of homelessness, we still insist on doing this unconstitutional and horrible public policy.
Did I ever tell you about getting denied housing? Because it was like, so that 1,000-foot thingamajigger, and the place I was trying to move into was like 996 or 990, something like that, and they said no. And the place that was a park was over there, and then it was a cul-de-sac, and there was a park bench, and there was a sign under that said something, something park, but there was just a concrete bench in this cul-de-sac, and that was the park. And I couldn't live in that house because it was 900 and change feet away.
Now, that's funny.
It's ridiculous, man. It's ridiculous. And the house was across the street. So it was like 200 feet from the police station.
So, yeah, I hear that all the time. Similar stories.
I'm sure you do. Moving along then to an article from USA Today. You put this in here about pretrial detention. It's titled Federal Magistrates, Prosecutors Misunderstand Bail Law, Jailing People Who Should Go Free. And this is from USA Today. So tell us about this one.
Well, according to the article, a Reagan-era law passed by Congress nearly four decades ago to change the federal bail system in order to address concerns over rising crime committed by arrestees released pending trial has been widely misunderstood and misapplied by the federal court systems, magistrate judges, prosecutors, public defenders, and probation officers, and as a result of a new two-year study has found.
The unprecedented look at federal pretrial detention conducted by the University of Chicago Law School's Federal Criminal Justice Clinic paints a portrait of a judicial system that has neglected the rights of especially poor arrestees and people of color. Such systemic problems are largely a result of what judges and advocates told USA Today is a poorly written, war on drugs era statute known as the Bail Reform Act of 1984, an over-reliance on prosecutorial discretion, and risk-averse magistrate judges and federal defenders. What changed after the Bail Reform Act was implemented?
Well, according to the report, here's what changed. In 1983, less than 24% of arrestees, now we're talking about federal now, so don't misconstrue, 24% of arrestees were jailed pretrial. By 2019, and it didn't take this long, it was very quickly after that, by 2019, nearly 75% of all of them were in pretrial detention. And as of June 30th, and I'm assuming it's talking about this past year, but of June 30th, 118,000 were federally jailed pretrial, according to federal court's data. At the same time, the amount of time presumably innocent people spent locked up awaiting trial has increased nearly sevenfold, from an average of less than 2 months in 1985 to nearly a year now, and they're presumed innocent. And we're detaining three quarters of the people accused of crimes, folks. This was a policy that was passed in the 80s. Congress had to pass it. Reagan couldn't have signed it if Congress hadn't passed it. But there was a lot of public pressure on Congress to do this because of there was supposedly the revolving door of catch and release. And the same thing that was said then is being said with the states now that have implemented bail reform where they're letting more people out pending trial. But anyway, go ahead.
I want to make sure that we are talking about people that are innocent until proven guilty, correct?
That is the theory of our Constitution, and I'm shocked. I'm shocked when our people are reluctant to say that. When I hear an interview and the person say that person should, when an alleged victim says that person should be in jail, on what basis do you say that? Well, they did so and so to my husband. Well, right. They're accused of doing that. They're presumed innocent.
And that's why you would then get held and then go before some we're talking about magistrate judges. You would go before one of them to be afforded bond. And unless you are like Jack the Ripper, shouldn't you go home? Possibly with some kind of monitoring of some sort or not even that.
That is what our system is supposed to be built upon. The presumption of innocence until you've either pled guilty or been convicted. Innocent people are not supposed to be held in custody.
According to the report, federal magistrate judges may over-detain out of the fear that someone they let go will commit a new crime or worry that they may lose their job since they serve terms at the discretion of the district court. So aren't federal judges appointed for life?
Federal judges are the ones that are district judge and above, but magistrate judges are not. The magistrate judges are appointed by the district court. And they must reapply regularly. I think they serve 6-year terms, but I'm not absolutely sure, but they must reapply.
The Bail Reform Act includes a narrow list of offenses that make an arrestee eligible for detention and a second hearing. Those include more serious violent crimes, crimes involving violence, guns, minor victims, or terrorism, most drug offenses, offenses carrying a maximum penalty of life imprisonment or death, and certain cases of recidivism. Prosecutors can argue there is serious risk an arrestee will flee or obstruct justice. If none of these offenses are involved nor conditions met, then an arrestee should be released at the initial appearance. And then, so Larry, you being the knower of all things judicial system, why are they not released?
I wish I could explain it. My guess is that similar to the issue we just talked about it with the probable cause hearings, the people who work in the system do not understand what they're supposed to be doing. That's one possibility. But when you look what the article said, when U.S. Magistrate Judge Jonathan Hawley first got to the bench in the Central District of Illinois over 8 years ago, he stated, "No one appearing in front of me, from the defense lawyers to prosecutors to probation officers, understand how the Bail Reform Act applied." And it was a shock to me. Now, you have to admit that that's funny.
I am not going to admit that that's funny. Not at all. Do you want to argue about what's funny now?
Well, if you've got a magistrate judge saying that of all the various key players from prosecutors to probation, federal probation is a significant player, that these people don't understand the Bail Reform Act, how else would you describe it if it's not funny?
Not funny at all. Juval O'Scott, the federal public defender in the Western District of Virginia, said when she took over the office in 2019, she instituted a policy that lawyers in the office had to challenge detention unless there was a reason not to. Since then, the district's release rate has gone up to almost 20%. Scott said, there were a lot of very seasoned defense attorneys that had no clue what the statute said, she said. They walked into court and they would agree that their clients could be detained even when the statute did not offer a basis for their detention. So we can't blame judges for detaining people if the defense bar doesn't step up and ask for their release and tell the court why. That is very sad. Larry, we're expecting that these people go to colleges and whatnot that teach them these things. Then they go to an institution, a workplace where they would then like, here's how we do this. This is what we are afforded constitutionally as the people that are being represented by, well, these people.
It's indeed sad because Congress, I think, intended the presumption of detention to apply narrowly to the worst of the worst. And that's what the article says. But under the statute, prosecutors are supposed to persuade judges that detention is necessary, and judges are supposed to weigh the presumption alongside an individual assessment of an arrestee. The report says all that. I don't understand. I really don't.
The But the real world comes down to, what was the judge's name in Persky?
Persky, yes.
Then it comes down to, so you go into court, you're standing there, and you've got your side defending you that's saying, like, you're the best person ever, and then the defense is painting a picture that you are the worst person ever, and then the judge is going to end up on the news that they let this terrible person accused of these things go home.
That is a fear, in particular for the magistrate judges who do not have lifetime appointments.
The report notes it's every judge's nightmare that they release someone who then goes out and does some violent act. What can be done? We would have to stop watching the ambulance chaser kind of news reports is what we would have to do.
Well, Congress could also pass amendments to the Bail Reform Act and make it abundantly clear that the presumption is that defendants should be released pending trial. Unfortunately, that's not likely to happen because its political right has been demonizing the states that have been trying to do that very thing to make it easier for defendants to be released pretrial. They say it's turning loose a tidal wave of crime on the innocent public. And you just cannot withstand that type of an assault. I mean, you just can't.
Can you remind me of some of the criticism that went on with the pretrial detention for those accused in the January 6th Capitol riot?
Well, there were some on the right who were very indignant that these people were being detained. And they are justified in their righteous indignation. But what disturbs me is that for 40 years, there was no indignation. I mean, we on the more progressive side, we've been complaining about this, those of us in the trenches practicing law, we've been complaining about the presumption of innocence being eroded and people being held pretrial. We've been sounding the alarm bells to no avail. And then when something like January 6th happens and you have your people being held pretrial, then suddenly it's a problem. Okay, fine. You've now realized it's a problem. Let's start working on a solution. Stop the demonization and let's start doing what you say you want done and changing the Bail Reform Act and making it abundantly clear that people should be released pending trial.
An individual in chat who is listening us live for the first time ever said federal supervised release was only supposed to be for the worst of the worst. It's how they sold the 85% of sentencing having to be served and no parole. I think that makes that makes sense as a comment.
So, but well, the abolition of parole, the old system we had in the federal, there was after a percentage, I'm not remembering if it was 30% or there was a percentage of the sentences that were served and then you were eligible to be released. That was abolished with the Sentencing Reform Act. It didn't have anything to do with the Bail Reform Act, but the Sentencing Reform Act abolished federal parole and it put in these guidelines because there was great consternation of what was referred to as a disparity in sentencing across the land. I mean, you had people on the more conservative side were saying, why is it that down here in Alabama, when someone robs a bank down here, we give them 12 years in federal penitentiary? And how come out there in San Francisco and that pond of sin out there, how come they get on probation out there for the same thing? And that's part of what drove that Sentencing Reform Act, to make sure that everybody goes to prison. So now we have the opposite. We have someone like Martha Stewart who makes a false statement about a stock trade that she would have made more money on had she not traded, but she's a convicted felon because of making a false statement, and she had to serve 5 months in the federal penitentiary.
Right. And then didn't she do house arrest too?
Yes, she did.
Very good. Anything else there before we dive into the little shindig that I wrote up?
No, let's do it because we're running short on time.
We are. I hope we can get through this. So I saw over on a subreddit for sex offender support, I found a post by someone who was convicted of CP type charges and he questioned the prevalence of illegal content. And it still makes me wonder, he says, why the government hasn't started a campaign to educate people on the hazards of possessing CP. Do you want to say anything about, do you think that it's the government's job at all to tell you the rules and dangers of having these things? I mean, like anything. MAD was the only thing, but that was driven by that organization. I don't see that our government, local, state, federal, does anything to inform us of what we should or shouldn't be doing.
I'm in agreement with you. I'm not sure. I mean, we do have public service type announcements, but I'm not sure that we have those, except for maybe with drunk driving, they tell you. And who pays for those announcements? I'm not sure. But if you don't know that looking at naked children is probably not ideal, then you've got more problems. Now, what I'm told, and I've not experienced this myself, I'm told that sometimes you don't know that you click on something and it opens totally different than what you expected. So I'm over my head on this. I don't know this stuff, but that's what I'm told, that actually people are not looking for it, but they click unknowingly on the stuff and then they've possessed it.
That you would then be in possession of it. So first, getting some feedback on this is like, what identifies CP? How is it identified? Is it like SCOTUS said at some point in time, the Supreme Court said, I know it when I see it, when they were referring to porn in general. Is it merely nudity? At some point in time, it crosses a line and it says, yep, that's what that is. Like, how would you, is it just a person in skimpy clothing? So, like, how would you even identify what is versus what isn't? I think that would be one area where, like, I don't know what, when you would call it that.
Well, the more egregious is very easy because it's age-based. Sure. You've got anyone under 18 for federal purposes is defined as a minor. So images of nudity, exposing the breast or the genital area. But then I think it goes beyond that. You know, there's these sexually suggestive poses that may qualify as well. Don't do federal work, so I don't know all the things that people get into complications with in the federal system, but it's age-based for sure. And then there becomes experts brought into play when you don't know the name of the person, can't identify the person, so therefore you don't know the age. So you have these experts come in and testify that that's the age of the body development of the person that's depicted in the images.
And just wouldn't that be super fuzzy that some develop very early and some develop very late?
That is correct. You could very well have that as a situation where someone could be fully developed and they could be 16 and they could look older. It's very difficult because part of the federal law prevents the images from being turned over to the defense attorney. In the old days, we would just get a copy of all that stuff and we would look at it. But I think after the Adam Walsh Act passed in 2006, now you have to view it under supervision and it's highly regulated because you're in possession of the porn yourself. So they don't give us a thumb drive with a discovery of those images. We have to go down and take a look.
My main focus in this segment is because you are very skilled with law, policy, and that whole apparatus. That's really the area that I'm trying to focus on with this conversation, not about how is it identified and all that stuff. So is there any incentive on... is there any incentive by the government to try and curtail this activity, do you think?
Well, depends on what, like Bill Clinton said, what the meaning of the word is.
Okay.
It depends on what you mean by incentive. There is an incentive to arrest people and prosecute people because that keeps the apparatus of law enforcement working, justifies their existence. Is there an incentive to reduce the incidence of it so that you don't need the law enforcement apparatus? I'm not so sure about that. I have never been convinced that the law enforcement apparatus wants to diminish its need. I think it's constantly trying to increase the justification for its need.
And so one, I was reading through the comments of the subreddit, so I've summarized some of them to toss at you, and says, one thought, it's a conspiracy. Just follow the money. Nothing is done about it as a way to constantly feed the beast through polygraphs, parole, probation payments, treatment providers, etc. Then throw in bonuses for extra overtime during events like Halloween for all the compliance checks. The question is then, is it simply a cash cow for the various parties? And that's prison, DA, law enforcement, kabuki machine operators, and the like.
The what kind of machine operators?
The kabuki machine operators. The ones who hook you up to the whole little machine and watch the little needles move back and forth.
Can you spell kabuki so we understand how it's spelled?
K-A-B-U-K-I.
Kabuki machine operator. All right.
Do you think that it's just a money machine for them?
I have a hard time believing these things come about that way, but they develop and evolve that way. You know, it'd be kind of like the Department of Homeland Security. For example, the Department of Homeland Security was a reaction to 9/11 and the fact that our various agencies could not coordinate well enough to respond quickly. But the Department of Homeland Security has evolved to be one of the big participants in the porn prosecutions. Anytime there's a federal prosecution, you can almost guarantee that the Department of Homeland Security has been involved in it. So I think once these things evolve and grow, kind of like the smart office with registration tracking and monitoring, the federal office that doles out money to the states, it needs to survive. It's not looking to eliminate its existence. So yes, I think that the Kabuki machine operators, the prosecutors, defense attorneys, all these people depend on a high level of cases rolling through there. If all of a sudden the federal caseload dropped by 60%, what would happen to all these people?
By God, the Kabuki machine operators would have to go legitimize their existence and do something real.
But what would probation officers, what would pretrial service workers do? What would the people that sell technology, the electronic monitoring, what would all these people do if federal apprehension and enforcement dropped by 50%? If we, the conservatives talk about wanting to downsize government. If we downsize the apparatus by 50% and reduced its capacity by 50% to prosecute and incarcerate, what would happen to all these people who are working in this system?
I got to tell you, to some degree, in a lot of those cases, then they would actually move into close to their operating capacity, where many places are operating at 110, 20, 120% of capacity. So they would almost come down to a normal load.
So, but it would result in a lot fewer people being employed over time. And nobody's sure for that.
Aren't we interested in like the public safety? So this is almost like, well, we'll let the system, we'll let the content stay out there so that we can continue to arrest and be employed, instead of the overall benefit of society and cutting the head off, killing the beast instead of just chopping a head off.
Well, I'm not qualified to talk about how the content gets out there. You know, people say that it's the federal government that runs it. I don't know that. I don't know that it is true. I don't know it's not true.
Another aspect of this is something we've mentioned on the podcast, and I don't know if we can ever actually verify it. I know that I've seen articles and heard people say it, but nothing really that verifiable. It says that 50% of the sites that are hosting this type of content are in fact run by government agencies. And the question here is, if some number of the sites are therefore funded by taxpayer dollars to ensnare those that access the content into the legal system, I guess in essence, feed the previous question. So I don't know how we would ever verify, but if the government, our taxpayer dollars, are running the servers that host the content, that I guess it's not entrapment by Larry's definitions, but sure seems like it.
Not entrapment, because they're not encouraging you to commit the crime. They're merely providing you the platform for to do something you have a predisposition to do, theoretically.
Right. Do you see any sort of parallel? Like, I mean, there's not a cocaine store up the street for you to go buy stuff that's run by the feds. Or there, I guess there might be.
Yeah, I don't know that, but.
So how about, and we kind of briefly touched on this, should there be some kind of public information campaign, as Nancy Reagan did back in the day, just say no, likely from peer pressure, do kids end up drinking and or doing drugs? Should there be some kind of YouTube ads or wherever to help get the word out about the consequences? And would it even help, though? I can't imagine that anybody really thinks looking at this content would be above board. For example, consider what you can buy at Walmart. Some items require proof of ID to buy, like some medicines. They sell guns and ammo, but they're in controlled areas. You have to make something of a concerted effort to find the content that you're not supposed to have. One poster wrote, I think there's an analogy to the drug war, and that I don't think it's a problem we're going to incarcerate our way out of. I think it requires a conversation about ending demand, and I think that requires policy and conversations about access to mental health treatment, sexuality, pornography, repression, etc., that I don't think we're ready to have. What are the steps needed to do something like this? Do you think like some sort of public awareness campaign and so forth, obviously it would take money. And who might fund that sort of thing?
That was going to be the question I would pose, is where would the money come from? I mean, we're more than willing to spend the money to incarcerate people, but spending money for treatment and prevention is a difficult sell, because you cannot ever measure what the effective rate, what the efficacy rate was of that stuff. We don't know what crimes would have been committed, because crime rates are not stagnant. So just because the rate didn't change much, it could have been that it was going to escalate by 40% without the prevention and the intervention and the, you know, the treatment. We just don't, it's difficult to prove. So therefore, it's difficult to secure public funding for prevention.
I have one final thing that I want to bring up, being like a technological person. It says, you have companies out there like Facebook and their parents and Google, so Meta and Alphabet, respectively. They can build algorithms to identify suspicious content. And that's computers looking at the images to try and see, they make determinations. And then they have some report mechanism that makes the, that takes the, they have processes in place that takes the information off of their sites. And I'm not saying it isn't there for you to do a Google search to find stuff. I'm just saying it's really hard. But if they have the mechanisms to do it, why can't our government do it? And again, another comparison is to the drug war. When you compare the money of the drug cartels have to what the U.S. spends, it's paltry by comparison. So, like, if that content ended up on a Facebook or Google type property, prosecutors would go hammer them. And so, like, they have an incentive to not have the content there for you to get it. So you have to go through some really covert, subversive channels to pick up anything of volume. So it just seems like it's possible to be done, but we don't do anything about it. It's really all I wanted to then add to the end of that.
Well, I think that Facebook and the big companies are doing something about it. They are putting the brakes on it, and they're turning it over to the authorities.
Agreed. And they have the ability to, so then it just moves elsewhere where it's now offline, not offline, but it's out of those mainstream kind of channels. Still seems like it would be plausible for the government. I guess then Fourth Amendment stuff, and they can't go search your stuff without a warrant. And so, like, it's very complicated, but it seems doable to some degree.
So, yeah, it's a conversation for another episode about how much we Absolutely. Want to have the government interfering with this kind of stuff.
So, well, very good. I don't have anything else, and we're a tad over time. Is there anything that you would like to say before we depart?
Looking forward to being back next week, one more week before Christmas.
Absolutely. Yep, one more show before Christmas, and then we'll take off. And I guess we'll be recording somewhere around New Year's Eve, aren't we? Or maybe we'll record a day earlier, like on the 30th, or maybe even a day later, one or the other. And so anywho, all you've got to do then is go find the show notes over at registrymatters.co. And that would be fantastic. You can find links to everything there to support the show over on the Patreon kind of place, or find the show notes and the transcript over at fypeducation.org. Thank you, everybody, that hung out in chat. We had a big, huge crowd tonight. And without anything else, sir, I would bid you a great weekend.
Good night.
Take care.
You've been listening to FYP.